Welcome to Base by Base. So let's talk about genetic testing. We all hear about its incredible potential in healthcare, right? Unlocking diagnoses, guiding treatments, helping families.
Absolutely. It's becoming fundamental. But there's a catch.
Yeah, the catch is actually getting the test. Have you, or maybe someone you know, faced those really long wait times to see a genetic specialist? It happens a lot.
It really does. And that's the core issue we're digging into today. The demand for clinical genetic testing is just skyrocketing.
But the number of clinical genetics experts, the specialists at counselors, isn't keeping pace. There's a bottleneck.
Exactly. A major bottleneck, which leads to this proposed solution, mainstreaming.
Right, mainstreaming, which basically means involving other doctors like your family doctor or maybe a cardiologist or a neurologist in parts of the genetic testing process.
The idea is to spread the workload, you know, to improve patient access.
And our guide for understanding this is a significant paper published, I believe, in Genetics in Medicine around 2023.
That sounds right. It's by Dr. Boycott and a large group of colleagues. Really a major Canadian effort. 35 experts, 20 different genetic services, representing all the provinces.
Wow, that's comprehensive. So they really aimed for a national consensus.
They did. It started with a focus group at the Canadian College of Medical Geneticists meeting, and they built out from there. The goal was clear: create a solid, conceptual framework for mainstreaming.
Because right now, it's sort of the Wild West, different places doing different things.
Pretty much. Approaches vary a lot, which makes it really hard to evaluate what actually works. You know, are we improving access? Is it sustainable? Is the quality there? We need a common language.
So that's the objective of the paper and what we're unpacking this framework, understanding the different ways mainstreaming can work and what influences the best approach.
It's like getting a roadmap for how genetics is integrating into day-to-day medicine.
Okay, so diving into the problem a bit more, the paper highlights that this isn't just for rare diseases anymore, or even just cancer genetics, where it sort of started.
Right. It's being considered across almost all areas of medicine now. But that lack of a standard approach, it really hinders evaluating those key outcomes we mentioned: accessibility, quality, patient satisfaction.
And they felt previous ways of thinking about genetic care models weren't detailed enough.
Exactly. They needed more granularity. You need to break down the entire testing pathway step by step to figure out where you can realistically shift responsibility and then measure the impact.
Which brings us to their methods, that consensus process. You mentioned the focus group.
Yeah, the experts work together to refine definitions, map out all the steps in testing, and identify the key factors, the variables, that influence how well mainstreaming might work in a given situation.
And critically, they expanded the author list beyond just medical geneticists.
Right. They brought in genetic counselors, lab geneticists, nurses, even a pediatric neurologist, someone who isn't a geneticist but uses this testing.
Mm.
That diversity of roles and regions was key for broad representation, even though the initial group was mostly medical geneticists.
Okay, let's get into their results then, starting with those core definitions they agreed on. Clear language is vital here.
Absolutely. Four key ones. First, mainstreaming. Shifting all or part of the clinical genetic testing process to clinicians outside the genetic service, specifically to improve patient access.
So it's flexible, could be a little bit or a whole thing.
Precisely. Second, diagnostic genetic test, defined broadly. Any lab test on chromosomes, DNA, RNA, methylation for a suspected genetic condition. Importantly, this includes the big genomic tests like exomes and genomes.
Got it. Not just single gene tests.
No. Third, genetic service. That's the whole specialized team. The clinicians seeing patients like geneticists and counselors, and the lab side interpreting the results. They work together.
Okay. And fourth?
Non-geneticist clinician. Any healthcare provider whose main specialty isn't genetics could be a physician, nurse practitioner who gets involved in the testing pathway.
So this framework acknowledges that non-geneticists might take on quite complex roles, not just ordering, which leads us to the actual pathway steps they mapped out.
Right. They broke it into four stages to see where those handoffs could happen. Stage one is assessment activities.
That's like recognizing a genetic condition might be possible.
Yes. Plus gathering history, personal, family, ethnicity, and really detailed phenotyping, which means describing all the patient's clinical features carefully.
Okay. Assessment first. Yeah.
Stage two, pre-testing activities. This involves choosing the best test, doing the pretest counseling, explaining what the test can and can't do, the possible outcomes, getting informed consent, ordering it, and making sure the lab gets the right sample.
Lots involved there, even before the lab sees anything.
Definitely. Stage three is the laboratory activities. Performing the test, interpreting the findings, writing the report, that part usually stays within the specialized lab.
It makes sense. And finally,
stage four, post-testing activities. This is huge. Disclosing the result, figuring out if it actually explains the patient's condition, that's clinical correlation, then navigating what comes next.
Like implications for treatment, maybe more testing.
That's exactly. Or cascade testing for family members, reproductive counseling, all that follow-up.
In the traditional model, the genetic service does pretty much all of stages 1, 2, and 4.
Correct. Mainstreaming means non-geneticists take on some activities in those assessment, pre-testing, or post-testing stages.
But it's not a free-for-all. This is where those influencing variables come in, right? The factors that decide if mainstreaming is a good idea for a specific test or patient.
Precisely. The paper outlines 6 categories of these variables.
Yeah.
It's less black and white, more of a spectrum of things that make a scenario more amenable or less amenable to mainstreaming.
Let's unpack some of those, patient characteristics.
Yeah. So if a patient has, say, a very clear set of symptoms affecting just one body system or maybe a simple family history, that's generally more amenable. Think straightforward.
Okay.
But if it's complex, multiple systems involved, tricky family history that needs deep interpretation, that's less amenable. It points towards needing a geneticist's diagnostic skills.
What about the disease characteristics?
Similar idea. If the condition doesn't rely heavily on a geneticist's specialized physical exam skills, maybe it's relatively common, managed within the non-geneticist's scope. Fewer big implications for family that's more amenable.
Like the hemochromatosis example you mentioned earlier.
Right. But if a detailed dysmorphology exam by a geneticist is key, or it's super rare, needs multi-specialty care outside the non-geneticist's wheelhouse, big family implications, less amenable.
And the test characteristics matter too, obviously.
Hugely. Simple sample needed, like blood for DNA. High accuracy, low complexity test. More amenable.
Versus needing, say, a skin biopsy or multiple relatives tested or RNA studies.
Exactly. Or if it's a test known for lower accuracy or high complexity, like interpreting a whole genome, less amenable. And the type of result is critical. A clear positive or negative is one thing.
But a variant of uncertain significance, a VUS.
That's often much trickier for a non-geneticist. So VUS results often make a scenario less amenable, pushing it back towards genetics expertise.
Okay, now you said some variables are modifiable. That sounds important.
It really is. Take non-geneticist clinician characteristics. Their ability to assess the patient's features, their familiarity with a specific reason for testing, their general comfort and understanding of genetics. These can all be improved with training and experience.
So more training makes mainstreaming more feasible.
Absolutely. High ability, familiarity, comfort equals more amenable. Low levels equals less amenable. Education is key.
And the diagnostic test report itself, that can be modified too.
Yes. If the lab report uses clear, simple language, explicitly states recommendations for follow-up or patient education that's more amenable.
Versus a dense, jargon-filled report with no clear next steps.
Which is much less amenable. Labs have a role in making reports more user-friendly for non-specialists.
And the big one, system characteristics, also modifiable.
Totally. Does the system provide easy access to genetics education for the non-geneticists? Decision support tools, clear guidance on how to order tests, open pathways for quick consults with genetics?
What about reimbursement?
Crucial. Adequate compensation models for the extra work non-geneticists take on. Low logistical hurdles. All those things make mainstreaming more amenable.
And the lack of those things, poor access to support, restricted test ordering, high barriers, no pay for the extra time, makes it less amenable.
What's fascinating here is just how many factors beyond the test itself really shape whether mainstreaming is practical or even possible. It's the whole ecosystem.
It really shows that mainstreaming isn't just a switch you flip. It requires building that support structure.
Right. And based on all that, the pathway steps and these influencing variables, the framework proposes 4 general models for mainstreaming. The key difference is when the genetic service gets involved or if they get involved directly in patient care.
Okay, let's walk through them. Model 1.
Model 1 is mainstreaming up to test selection. They call it the 2-test model. Here, the non-geneticist does the initial clinical assessment, gathers history.
But then they hand off before the test is even chosen.
Essentially, yes. The genetic service steps in pretty early, to help select the optimal test and arrange it, often before the patient's first formal genetics appointment.
What's the benefit there?
Potential efficiency for the patient. They might have results ready when they finally see the geneticist, speeding things up, but it still uses significant genetics resources up front for that test selection piece.
Okay, model two.
Mainstreaming up to result disclosure, or the to-result model. Here, the non-geneticist does more. Identifies the patient, counsels them pre-test, orders the test.
And genetics takes over only when the result comes back.
Exactly. Responsibility shifts at result disclosure. Genetics handles explaining the result and managing the follow-up. This might work well in settings like oncology, where oncologists order panels, but genetics manages the complex results and family implications.
Requires a very clear handoff, I imagine.
Definitely. Mutual understanding of roles is key.
All right. Model three. Mainstreaming up to post-disclosure navigation, the two-navigation model.
Now the non-geneticist handles almost everything up to and including disclosing the results.
Wow. Okay. So genetics only gets involved after the result is given.
Conditionally.
Yeah.
Their involvement depends on those variables.
Yeah.
The result type. Is it a VUS? The complexity of the condition. Is it multi-system outside the non-geneticist's scope? Or the need for specific follow-up like cascade testing or reproductive counseling?
So if it's a straightforward result for a condition the non-geneticist manages routinely,
they might handle everything. Genetics might not need to be involved directly at all, or maybe just for a quick consult.
You mean example?
A pediatrician ordering a chromosomal microarray for a child with autism. If the result is clearly pathogenic for a known syndrome they're familiar with, they might manage it. But if it's a complex VUS or indicates a rare multisystem disorder, then they refer to genetics. Or a neurologist ordering an epilepsy panel.
That makes sense. It puts more responsibility on the non-geneticist, but keeps genetics as a backup for complexity. They do mention VUSs are still a challenge here, though.
They do. Interpretation often needs that specialist input, though maybe better reporting helps over time.
And the final one, model four.
Completely mainstreamed. The non-geneticist handles the entire pathway. Assessment, ordering, counseling, disclosure, management, follow-up.
When would that be appropriate?
Usually for common conditions with really clear phenotypes and well-understood genetics, where the non-geneticist likely already has expertise. Think testing for HFE hemochromatosis or maybe sickle cell trait screening.
Or a specialist who's developed deep expertise in the genetics of their own field, like a renal geneticist.
Exactly. Someone who essentially functions like a geneticist for their specific niche.
But crucially, even in models 3 and 4, genetics isn't gone. They're still there for support.
Absolutely critical point. The genetic service remains available for consultation, for complex cases, for family screening support, reproductive counseling. That support might look different, maybe an embedded counselor, maybe e-consults, but it's there. It's part of making these models work.
So stepping back, what does this framework really achieve? What's the main takeaway from the discussion section of the paper?
I think the biggest thing is it provides that common language and structure. It allows different health systems or clinics to actually design, implement, and most importantly, evaluate their mainstreaming efforts in a consistent way.
So we can finally compare apples to apples, see what approaches work best under which circumstances.
Exactly. And they emphasize it's dynamic. A test scenario might start in one model, but shift as things change. Maybe the non-geneticists get more training, or the system puts better supports in place. Those modifiable variables are key.
But they also acknowledge the big challenges, the systemic barriers we talked about earlier.
Yes. Lack of education, policy issues, report clarity, compensation, these all need to be tackled for mainstreaming to really take hold and be successful and equitable.
Which points to the need for that genomics-informed workforce. Education seems paramount.
It is. And the paper really stresses that the genetics community needs to actively support that education for their non-genetics colleagues.
And what about the future role of the genetics service itself?
It evolves. Less gatekeepers, more expert hub, supporting mainstreaming, handling the truly complex cases, ensuring equitable access for those who need specialist care. It's a shift in focus, not elimination.
They also mention limitations in their conclusions, right?
Yeah, they're upfront. It's primarily a Canadian context, though likely transferable. Mm. The initial group was mostly geneticists, so broader input, especially from patients and non-geneticists in the design phase, is needed going forward.
And the big call to action.
Evaluation, evaluation, evaluation. We need to measure the outcomes. Do the benefits outweigh the risks? Are patients getting timely diagnoses and the support they need? What does utility even mean from different perspectives, the patient, clinician, system? We need better tools to measure that.
So to wrap up, this paper gives us a really practical roadmap, a way to think structurally about integrating genetic testing more broadly, optimizing resources, and hopefully improving care.
It moves the conversation beyond just if we should mainstream to how we can do it effectively and responsibly.
So, the provocative thought for you, the listener, this framework helps us ask much more specific questions. Not just is mainstreaming happening, but how exactly? Who's doing what step? And why is that the chosen approach for this particular test in this particular clinic for this particular patient?
Yeah, think about how this shift might change your potential future interactions with healthcare if genetic testing becomes relevant. Who would you expect to discuss it with? What support would they need to do it well? It really reframes how genetics fits into the bigger picture of medicine.
This episode is based on an open access article under the Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License, CC BY 4.0. You'll find the DOI and a link to the license in the episode description.